Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is broadcast number 461, October the 5th, 1980, side one of the tape. We break up the half hour and turn over a tape cassette for those that take the program by subscription. I'm sure many of you saw the Arthur Miller play on television, Playing for Time, the story of the concentration camp at Auschwitz. I thought it was an interesting movie. It was a three-hour movie. It wasn't anything new. Unfortunately, we look at the past as if it was the past and don't relate to what is happening in the present. For all of my 17 years of research, I feel that many people, the majority of the people I've come in contact with, are simply doing what those women were doing in the concentration camp, which is playing for time. Most people are political prostitutes. They are looking the other way while multitudes, millions, are murdered. Individuals are murdered. Their friends are murdered. Friends of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, men on the balcony like Andrew Young and Jesse Jackson don't speak up, don't want an investigation who killed their friend Martin. These people are nothing but a bunch of pimps and bums who are fiddling and playing their instruments, whatever instruments they're good at, vocal cords or whatever, and looking the other way. Their friends' heads are blown off in the Bastrow Hotel, Robert Kennedy, and in Dallas with John Kennedy, and the murders go on, and the official government, the presidents that succeed them, members of Congress, the personal members of their family, the judges and people that should be opening up these cases ignore it. The friends are unforgivable. The family members are unforgivable. Researchers have tried to alert to what is going on, the situation that is going on, but there are very few people that want to do anything but play for time. It's happening now, so we don't have to go all the way back to Auschwitz to see the phenomena taking place. I'm going to talk this evening on three articles that Jack Anderson came out with recently. I referred to one last week, the Jonestown CIA connections. But Jack Anderson, I've criticized him for a long, long time for avoiding certain problems in our political scene that he totally ignores these and goes on to others. For whatever reason, I don't know. He's very selective in the way he chooses his articles. That's his privilege, just as I'm selective in the things that I choose to put on the radio programs. But being a political analyst of many events taking place all around him, he ignored certain news stories for a long, long time, and now he's hit upon them. He has started this last week talking about Paul Laxalt, who is the manager for Ronald Reagan's campaign. He's the campaign chairman, a Republican from Nevada in the Senate, and he started writing about the connections of Laxalt to Howard Hughes, and that's what the Ronald Reagan campaign is about. We'll go into that. He also brought out memos another day this last week on Laxalt, Howard Hughes, and the racism of the Hughes organization and Laxalt, and using his vote and his office to put down blacks in Nevada and then later in the Senate, United States Senate, and being well paid by the Hughes organization with retainers and carrying on their tradition of racism. Jack Anderson also had an article about Carlos, the terrorist, and being saved by the Central Intelligence Agency. And then I want to go into some items of justice, but justice is very important. It is something to watch. I've watched the courts ever since I started studying the assassination of John Kennedy and then into the other assassinations, and turned on to a book that I've referred to many times on the rearmament of Germany, a section of that book written by A.J. Gumbel, in which he describes Nazi Germany and how Hitler came to power in 1933. And he describes 400 political assassinations that he wrote about in the 30s, but I've never seen the book. I'm sure it was destroyed by Hitler. And Gumbel then said that the killing of the people wasn't as difficult as keeping the semblance of justice, that the courts had to be overturned so that the guilty were loose and free to do the killings again. And a person may not be totally innocent, but he may not be the person responsible entirely for the crime he was charged, or they would say he was escaping or that he commit suicide. And that person would be slain by the Nazi courts, and then the court hearings would be over, or the court was quieted down in cases that should have been getting more attention. So it was the manipulation of the courts in Germany that was taking place, and it's the manipulation of the courts in the United States today that concerns me and that is taking place. The Laxalt article that Howard Hughes, that Jack Anderson referred to last week, this was September 29th, 1980, was in the San Francisco Chronicle. It was also in the Monterey Herald. The Monterey Herald has a much longer article. We get 5 inches more of Jack Anderson, and it seems important sections are deleted from the San Francisco paper. And I've mentioned this before. He brought in the fact that new documents, they're new to some people, and some of us haven't seen all of them, of course. New documents are being published in a book by an author, Michael Drosnin. I mentioned him on a tape, the cassette, about a year ago. A book called Citizen Hughes, in his own words, How Howard Hughes Tried to Buy America. This is based upon documents that were stolen from the Howard Hughes headquarters in 1974. And Jack Anderson refers to this book. Interesting that the title is How Hughes Tried to Buy America in the past tense. The Hughes organization is very much intact today. The network of buying off politicians, the blackmailing, the under-the-table subterfuge, the connection of the CIA, the mafia, organized crime with the politicians, the Resorts International Combine, the Hughes organization as it existed and as it has continued to exist is not dead. The title, How Hughes Tried to Buy America, is a bad word, as I say, using the past tense, because later in the article, and I'm going to refer to it in case you didn't see it, the subject comes up, and Paul Laxalt asked the FBI to find out if Howard Hughes was actually alive when he was in Nevada. And that's an open-ended question to this day. Did he die before he ever got to Nevada, or some interim between the Nevada and 1976 when he was legally dead? Of course, I wrote an article for Playgirl in 74 that he had died in April of 1971. But if Howard Hughes was not in Nevada, and Senator Paul Laxalt asked J. Edgar Hoover to go into it, and Hoover said, absolutely not. And Robert Mayhew was an FBI man, so Hoover could have gone to him. If Laxalt was dealing with what he referred to as a possible hoax, then the hoax could be going on continuously, because in this article, Jack Anderson brings up the question of whether or not Hughes was in fact in Las Vegas and whether it was a hoax. He refers to the fact that Robert Mayhew worked for Howard Hughes, and these memos that are available that are surfacing in the book are correspondence between Howard Hughes and Robert Mayhew. Mayhew was an agent from the Central Intelligence Agency. He had been working with the CIA since 1960 when he set up, well, maybe longer before, in counterintelligence. But for Hughes and the CIA in 1960 with assassination teams that he set up that were confirmed in the Senator Church Committee, this is in 1975, those hearings. But Mayhew worked for the CIA and he worked for the FBI, and he moved to Las Vegas when the Hughes empire moved into Vegas in 66 and shared a house with Mo Dalitz of organized crime, who was part of the assassination team that the CIA had asked Mayhew to work with. Mo Dalitz then went on to La Costa. He formed La Costa in California. But a very close buddy of Robert Mayhew's during this interim was John Roselli. He was murdered and found sunken off of a Florida coast at the time the House Select Committee on Assassinations was going to call John Roselli. Sam Giancana was murdered before. Oh, John Roselli had testified, and it was Sam Giancana who was murdered a few weeks before he was to testify. So Robert Mayhew of the FBI and the CIA was sharing housing with Mo Dalitz and worked closely with John Roselli of organized crime. This is an important point because the memos going back and forth between Hughes go to Robert Mayhew. Mayhew never saw Howard Hughes. Memos go to Paul Laxalt, who never saw Howard Hughes. Chester Davis, who worked for Howard Hughes, never saw Howard Hughes. One of the memos had to do with working with Paul Laxalt and giving him a lot of money. This is a quotation from the newspaper this week. To make the Laxalt deal work, we have to find a means of motivation. When I have a real tough assignment, I search for two ingredients. One, a man who can do the job if he truly wants to. This is the senator of Nevada that went on to become, the governor of Nevada that went on to become senator. Two, the means of furnishing a consideration to this man who will be of such a nature and such an amount as to be well nigh overpowering in its effect upon the man. Now, money was transacted to Paul Laxalt. It went to the law office of his brother, who was officiated with the lawyer in charge of the gaming tables. In Nevada, special favors were given to a corporation called Hughes Empire without ever having seen Howard or getting signatures for him to get all of these seven casinos. The memo said, "Now, Bob, I think Laxalt can be brought to a point where he will just about entrust his entire political future to his relationship with us. I think we must convince him beyond a shadow of a doubt that I intend to back him up with unlimited support right into the White House in 1972. Now, these memos were taken out of a safe in 1974, and he wanted Paul Laxalt in the White House in 72. It's interesting to combine that with the William Colby Howard Baker reports on Watergate and the evidence of Watergate and the Glasshouse tapes of Lewis Tackwood that G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt worked with the Los Angeles Police Department and intended to kill Richard Nixon at the San Diego conventions in 1972. They were down in San Diego. And then they were quickly moved to Miami in April of that year before the conventions. And after Nixon was Watergated by the same people from the Squad 19 that was going to have him killed at a football game, football field, at the time of the conventions and make Spiro Agnew the president of the United States, and then Paul Laxalt could be selected as the vice president. So the goal of Hughes isn't different than what was going to transpire. Now, when Richard Nixon was Watergated with that Scotch tape, the very first thing he did within just minutes of his realizing what was coming down at the Watergate Hotel was to pull the rug out under Spiro Agnew to make sure that Agnew didn't become president. And I'm sure by Richard Nixon doing that, it kept Paul Laxalt out of being appointed vice president under Spiro Agnew. So the years have passed, and now Ronald Reagan is running for president come November, and the man running his campaign, who will be in his cabinet, very close to Ronald Reagan, the 9-to-5 president, so Paul Laxalt can make the decisions from 5 p.m. to 9 in the morning if Reagan's asleep. The man that the Hughes organization wanted in the White House will, in fact, be very close to the White House within 6 weeks from now. As I say, Richard Nixon pulled the rug out from Spiro Agnew very quickly and had him removed before Nixon resigned from office as president of the United States. There was an article this week about Spiro Agnew, the federal judge who accepted his resignation, the no-contest plea. U.S. Judge Walter Hoffman said this week that he did it quickly. He said, if I hadn't accepted the plea, Agnew would have been indicted of many charges, but he would have held back and contested those. And when Nixon was out of office, Agnew would have been president. And the judge said he automatically would have been president of the United States, and God knows that would have been a tragedy. It was a wise decision to get Agnew out before President Nixon got out of office. Robert Mayhew wrote back to Howard Hughes. This is among these other memos that's printed by Jack Anderson this week, in quotes, "Governor Laxalt has started to ask me precisely what his assignment will be in our organization." That's interesting because after this correspondence was going back and forth, Laxalt was not the governor of Nevada. He went on to be a senator, a more important position in the United States Senate. And now, as I say, he's the campaign manager for probably the next president of the United States. Robert Mayhew wrote to Howard Hughes in 1970. Keep in mind that this is a combine, a conglomerate. It's not a person. He said, "Laxalt is very anxious to discuss his future employment with us." And then Mayhew wrote, "My guess is that he, Laxalt, will hit us for a retainer." Jack Anderson went on to say that Laxalt's law firm got $180,000, his brother's firm, Peter Laxalt, and that Laxalt also got other money. In return, the favor he did was to circumvent the procedure by which the Hughes organization could buy up seven casinos in Las Vegas and have unlimited organized crime, skimming money, prostitution, blackmail, keeping Vegas the city of more suicides than any other city in the United States, and I'm sure that one-third of those are murder. Hughes got the license for 7 casinos. He didn't have to go through the other routes. He was never seen. And then when he left in 1970, Resorts International and Intertel took over and literally owned most of Las Vegas. Jack Anderson wrote, in a bizarre twist, it turns out that Laxalt had never met Howard Hughes. He had serious doubts that the man was still alive. In February of 1967, February the 12th, a confidential memo was written. This is 1 year after Hughes' organization was in Nevada and no one had seen him. This is a year after he moved in. No one, including the governor of Nevada, has ever personally seen Howard Hughes. There is grave concern among the Nevada gaming authorities and Governor Laxalt that a great hoax could be perpetuated on the state officials. And then the memo went on to say that Laxalt and the Nevada Gaming Commission wanted the FBI to determine that Howard Hughes is alive and that they are actually licensing a live individual. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover ordered his men to have absolutely nothing to do with this. Despite his doubts of whether or not Hughes was ever in Nevada, Paul Laxalt, now campaign manager to Ronald Reagan, subsequently helped the Hughes organization get their casinos. And the article by Jack Anderson does bring up the question of the existence of Howard Hughes. I'll do more on that on another broadcast or tape because I have a lot I want to cover this evening. But J. Edgar Hoover was the head law enforcement official of the United States. It is a law to kidnap people to take them across state lines. Howard Hughes was taken from California to Boston to Nevada. There was no evidence that he was alive. Hoover had a request to investigate him. Mayhew, who was being paid by the Hughes organization and lived with Mo Dalitz and worked with John Roselli and assassination teams of Giacana and organized crime members, Mayhew was a member of the FBI at the same time he worked with the crime figures and as an agent could have gone to the apartment of Howard Hughes, the man who paid him, and find out if, in fact, he was Hughes. The FBI had the authority to see if a man in that hotel room, whose name was Vance Cooper, had been kidnapped, had been drugged under subterfuge, who was kept in that hotel room and impersonated Howard Hughes. They had the right to go in there, and FBI didn't do it. And the reason they didn't do it, I firmly believe, is the same reason that J. Edgar Hoover never went into the Nazi connections in this country. It has to do with his being vice president of Interpol, which was Adolf Hitler's police organization. Until we were bombed at Pearl Harbor, Hoover was working with Meyer Heydrich and the top Nazis of Nazi Germany, Kaltenbrunner, and the war criminals of Germany. And J. Edgar Hoover had pro-Nazi, anti-labor, anti-black, anti-Jewish feelings. His Jewishness extended to maybe Meyer Lansky, a mob figure. Bugsy Siegel was wiped out, but J. Edgar Hoover worked with Nazis and organized crime, and his role as head of the FBI was to ignore the Howard Hughes story. And I also believe that the subterfuge of the Hughes organization has been for the Nazification of America. I think it is the umbrella of bringing Nazis here from Germany under NASA into the Defense Department, into Lockheed, into the space stations. And it's no coincidence that the Hughes organization funded Richard Nixon in 1946 to become a member of the House of Representatives when he ran against Jerry Voorhees, and then Richard Nixon in 1950 was bringing Nicolae Maloxa, a top Nazi from Romania, to his office in Whittier and then down to Argentine and to the Odessa organization. The memos that Paul Laxalt wrote asking the director of the FBI to check out Hughes were not done. But that wasn't just J. Edgar Hoover's problem, because Laxalt kept dealing with this party, being the governor of the state, and not knowing who he was dealing with and taking money from that organization up to this present day. Another article after that one that was in the paper a day later was more on Laxalt. This is a Howard Hughes article about Paul Laxalt killing a civil rights bill at the request of Howard Hughes. They felt if they gave him enough money, there's notes and memos here, that if they gave him enough money, that he would kill bills in Nevada when he had a chance as the governor. He lobbied behind the scenes to kill open housing bills and pretended on the front to be supporting it. He was active in continuing the racist intentions of the youth organization. And in those years, that was the time that Candy Jones wrote about. She was trained in the CIA to hate blacks, hate Jews, hate Italians. That was part of her mind control program. There's another memo here of the youth organization, which stated after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in 1968, that's the era when the youth organization was in Nevada from 66 to 70. It refers to Dr. Martin Luther King and said there'll be tremendous pressure to adopt a more liberal attitude towards integration, open housing, and employment of more Negroes after King was killed. But they went on to say, I feel the Negroes have already made enough progress to last the next 100 years, and there's no such thing as overdoing it. The youth organization has been instrumental in selecting the presidents of the United States, the justices of the Supreme Court, on down to the local police department. And this one article about the Laxalt behind-the-scene maneuvering for racism, I think, is important, coming out at this time of Jack Anderson. I have one memo that was published, I think it was in Playboy a while back. It's also the copy of a directive in Mexico Hotel when they were cashing in that body that was supposed to be used in 1976, and they were shredding articles. And this was to Chester Davis. He wants all our files on our CIA relations destroyed. This is also to apply to everything we have on Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Paul Laxalt, and O'Callaghan. O'Callaghan was the governor of Nevada. He wants this done immediately, and any taped conversations are also to be handled this way. This information about Laxalt, Nixon, Ford, and O'Callaghan, and now Laxalt really is the man behind Reagan as he runs him into the White House. So you get Nixon, Ford, Reagan under the control of what is the Hughes organization that is a much, much bigger monster. Jack Anderson also had an article on Jackal. That's Carlos. I referred to him on the last few tapes. Linked to the arms merchants Turpel and Corcola, who fled the country recently instead of being charged with murder and gun running and training terrorists. I mentioned them 2 weeks ago in an article in Nation magazine about Carlos and the Munich Olympic Games being behind the killing of the Jewish athletes. Carlos bombed the Israeli bank in London in 1974. He shot a Zionist, Joseph Siff, in London in 1973. He planted bombs in the Jewish newspaper in 1974 in Paris. He organized the murder of the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympic Games. Those are just the anti-Semitic efforts that Carlos has done that I refer to a few of them. And this article of Jack Anderson is a story how the CIA saved Carlos, that they had picked him up in 1974 and an assassination squad. It's interesting, he refers to Operation Condor. Jack Anderson has referred to them several times. That is a group of assassins trained in Chile, a colonial dignitas that borders on Argentina. And he said that Operation Condor, for one reason or another, wanted to wipe out Carlos. I guess it was time for him to go. They had reasons they wanted him killed. And he refers to this Condor as being a six-nation consortium of killers of South American dictatorships. Well, of course, Condor is the heritage of Permandex that included London and South Africa and Italy, Argentina and Chile. It's six nations, but they're not all South American. Operation Condor had its headquarters. Credit Suisse was one of the bankers, and money from Montreal. The money going down to Colonial Dignitas comes from Germany and is funded from South Africa at the present time. But the article about Carlos says that he was going to be killed, and the Central Intelligence Agency, according to certain documents, came in and spared his life. Now, if they knew where to find him, they could bring him in and charge him for these bombings and these murders, and multi-murders all over the country, bombing of airports. Besides the Jewish problem, he worked with the Palestinians in Jordan against King Hussein, and hit London cocktail parties and airports, and worked with the Japanese Red Army, Bader Meinhof, and all the terrorists gang that we used to believe, or the Tooth Fairy told us, were coming from the left. Well, Carlos was going to be killed in a mafia-like precision. He was going to be murdered, but the Central Intelligence Agency stepped in, warned the government, don't touch him, tell the Condor Nations to call off the murder of Carlos, and it goes on to suggest that Carlos was a CIA informant. So for all the years that I've talked about the terror on the right looking like the terror on the left, it's very significant that Jack Anderson had those articles today. Incidentally, there was an article in a newspaper today in the Washington Post, this week from the Washington Post, on Carlos and Turple and Corcola. Turple has left the country, and the article says that Turple, the CIA man who armed Idi Amin and Gaddafi in the Middle East, has a lawyer in common with a ABSCAM defendant, Representative John Jenrette of South Carolina. He's been investigated this past week. He's been under investigation by the courts because of the ABSCAM story. He has been allegedly involved in a lot of narcotic traffic and terrorism that comes out of South Carolina. And now the attorney, Kenneth Michael Robinson, Jenrette's attorney, is also Turple's attorney. Now, the example of using the terrorism of the left and making it of the really the terror of the right and making it look like the left is exemplified in an article this week that came out about the FBI and their court case of being wiretapping in the Weatherman case. And the excuse for the defense of the FBI of having to do burglaries and secret mail openings and entries was the kind of terrorism in the United States, such as the Arabs, the Al-Fatah, that were involved in the Munich kidnappings of the athletes and then the murdering them at the airport. Well, if the defense of the FBI violence and terrorism in the United States is based upon international terrorism, and the international terrorism is really done by the CIA, the story exemplifies very clearly why the SLA or the Al-Fatah or the Red Brigade are set up. They're set up so that the police state has the muscle to go in and wiretap and bug and follow you. The CIA and the Defense Department creates the terrorists. Then the law enforcement come in and say, there's so much terrorism, we need more jails and more police. The article this week from the United Press says, more FBI burglaries of Arab offices revealed, and it's the story of the Information Center in 1972 looking for members of the Al-Fatah and the manhunt of the PLO following the Munich, the murders at the Olympic Games. And while the investigation and the defense of the FBI in illegal activities is going on, other articles in the newspapers at the same time are saying that those terrorists were associated with the Central Intelligence Agency. The problem with getting the news in, say, any newspaper, any single set of papers or 10 papers a day like I take, or 20 or 30, is that you take one story of what the FBI is saying in defense of their trial, and you take another story about Turple from the Washington Post or Jack Anderson, and you put them together and you get a total different ingredient of what terrorism is and how it is used for a police state to get its muscles. Another article, the Associated Press today in the San Jose Mercury, terrorism is the worst yet to come. An article, according to the CIA, 579 people were killed by terrorism last year. But it doesn't say if 560 of those were done by CIA agents, such as, they quote, the Aldo Moro kidnapping by the Red Brigades, which later has turned out to be linked to the right-wing terrorists. They use, the example, the Olympic Games in Munich, the Palestinians shot at three Japanese at Lod Airport in Tel Aviv, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst and the Symbionese Liberation Army, and the hijacking of Air France, the jet plane that ended with an Israeli raid in Uganda. Now, the Uganda Army and that PLO operation was funded by Samuel Cummings, Turple, Frank Turple, George Corcola, the Central Intelligence Agency. It's been confirmed that they were arming and giving the planes and equipment to Idi Amin. And then, when all the terrorism comes down, the CIA comes out with large pieces of information for congressional testimonies, for courts, And every bit of terrorism that the CIA cites in this article, and the word CIA is in this, it's a half-page article, just today's newspaper, and they use the CIA references about 20 or 30 times. And everyone they're referring to in the last 3 months has gone back to their very agencies, like Frank Turpel of the Central Intelligence Agency and Carlos of the CIA and their operations. So the purpose of that kind of terrorism is to make it look as if the left is out of control like a wildfire, and the only solution to have is the police department. There are two kinds of terrorism, and I'll just mention them before we take a break at this half hour. There's the counterintelligence terrorism, where the far right does it and makes believe the left did it, so the left is punished and discredited. Then there's the Nazi Klan terrorism, the burning of the synagogue, bombing of synagogue in France this week, killing Jewish people at prayer, or the training of the Klan in Alabama or Mississippi, where they say, Klan wants race war. They say, I hate you. I hate blacks. I hate Jews. Let's get it on. Let's have our war. We're ready. We're armed. We hate you. They're not pretending to help them and then bombing, or they're not bombing and doing a counterintelligence. What these people are doing, the Klan and the Nazis, is saying, this is what we are. We don't like you. We're going to kill you. That is regular terrorism, and counterintelligence terrorism creates violence and murder and makes it look like one segment of society did it when it was actually the other segment. Now, it's a half hour. We're going to take a 30, 60-minute break here. It's Mae Bressel and Carmel, and then we'll be back on for the second half of this program.